A heated debate getting hotter. It's over a ballot question that asked whether or not we should amend the state constitution. The measure would give the state legislature the power to tax investment property to fund public education. This week, a group of faculty members came out in support of the proposal. They call themselves the Hawaii Scholars for Education Social Justice. The group released a research brief detailing the underfunding of Hawaii's public school system and how that underfunding hurts certain groups of residents more than others. Jonathan Okamura is professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii Manoa and a member of the Scholars for Education and Social Justice.
70% of public school students are indigenous and ethnic minority students. The largest group are Native Hawaiians at 27%, followed by Filipino Americans, 21%, some Micronesian students, 7%. Then we can add Samoans, Tongans, other Pacific Islanders, Latinos, African Americans, and you come up with a figure of more than 70%. So that substantial percentage of public school students are being disadvantaged, have been disadvantaged for decades by the chronic underfunding of the public school systems. This is evident in the underrepresentation, substantial, of these students at UH Manoa. Hawaiians and Filipinos represented a little more than half among undergraduates at UH Manoa. This, to me, clearly indicates the deficient quality of the education provided to those students. They don't continue in the educational pipeline to UH Manoa. That has contributed to the declining enrollment at Manoa over six consecutive years. The differential impact that the underfunding of the public school system has on minority students is not raised as an issue at all in those who express opposition to the constitutional amendment. Some of them don't even talk about students. They just talk about teachers without addressing what are the negative impacts of underfunding over the decades for the students and the differential impact, as I said, upon minority students.
Professor Okamura cited a 2005 Board of Education report that found the Department of Education would need an additional $278 million every year to provide what it called an adequate education. That figure was reexamined recently by an economist at UH West Oahu. Lawrence Boyd said he believes the department would now need an additional $297 million every year. He says raising those funds through property taxes could have a positive effect.
There's substantial economic literature that says higher property tax rates lead to lower home prices. In Hawaii, because we have low property taxes, it becomes an investment opportunity for people out of state. So the idea is if you raise that property tax rate, then the demand from out-of-state buyers will decrease and at least temper the rise in home prices, or if it's high enough, lead to decline in home prices. There's actually a concrete example of this. Vancouver has had entry of like lots of out of community, out of country buyers for their real estate market. It's actually driven up single family home prices in Vancouver, at least up to 3 years ago, to where when you take into account the difference in the Canadian dollar, they were almost identical to Hawaii. But they correctly targeted what was driving prices. They increased the property tax rate on, and it was targeted towards these out-of-community buyers. And the result was, in the first year of the program, home prices declined slightly, but basically, over the couple of years, it has flattened the rate of home price, the rate in the rise of home prices in Vancouver.
Both Lawrence Boyd and Professor Okamura agreed that addressing the high teacher turnover should be the first focus of any additional funding. Boyd said that a clear solution to that problem in the private sector.
When the private sector has this problem, they address it with higher wages. For example, Henry Ford, at the start of his enterprise in 1914, had to hire 52,000 workers to keep 14,000 employees working in his manufacturing plant. So he doubled the salary and reduced the work time from 9 hours to 8 hours. The knock-on effects of that was there were increased productivity. They didn't have to spend as much on recruitment. And so the price of a Model T actually fell by half over the next 10 years. Now, then the next example is the modern one. Walmart was having a similar turnover problem. They couldn't keep their employees. So they raised every employee who was averaging, associate who was averaging $9 an hour to $14 an hour. And that problem was solved. Most recently, Amazon raised all of their employees' minimum wage from around $10 to $15, a 33% increase. If you have a high turnover rate, you're not going to effectively do the job, produce the things you need to do, whether it be education, cars, or selling Walmart goods.
Now, all four county mayors oppose the measure. The county councils are now raising their voices. The Big Island's Tim Richards is a member of the Hawaii State Association of Counties.
This is actually not a conversation about the need of funding for public education. Everybody agrees that we need more funding for public education. Where the question comes is, what's the vehicle actually going to be? And that's where the disagreement comes. So first, I want to get off the table. Hawaii County, like everyone else, we strongly support the need for more funding to public education. As far as where we're coming from, the use of real property tax, which for the Hawaii County is about 3/4 of our income stream for our county, we don't support it. As written, the legislation is so vague, it's kind of a wide open potential for legislation that could come forth that, again, with no parameters around it, no idea of how things are going to function, this really deeply concerns me as a councilman, as well as I know some of the other members on the council. And again, we haven't discussed this per se because it hasn't come before us, but there's very strong feelings that this is our funding mechanism for our county. And without that funding and complete oversight of that funding, we're deeply concerned if it impacts us. We're talking about a state function, and this is our county revenue source. So there's other ways to get funding from the state, not through our real property. And, you know, if we want to look at and talk about the county of Hawaii as it stands right now, we've been through quite a bit this year. It's not 2018. It's not been a great year for us. We've had one after another natural disasters. Kauai has had some issues with that as well. The amount of damage we're trying to deal with is huge. Even the flooding from the rainfall from Hurricane Lane, we're still dealing with that. Estimates are 20 million plus of the damages we have to compensate with that. We've lost homes because of the lava inundation. The number sits around 700. We're told maybe another 300 are uninhabitable. And I bring that up because that also figures into our real property tax collections. We had to implement a 0.25% GE tax surcharge to balance our budget just to get through this next year. The concept of having any further impact on that real property tax, deeply concerning for us. I come back to the fact that we have one of the highest tax burdens in the nation here in Hawaii. It's not just real property. It's the GE tax. It's everything else. And so adding more tax does affect our people. And again, coming back for the Big Island, our economy is taking it pretty hard. We don't need to assign more taxing to our constituents. Like I said, this is not the right vehicle to get funding for public schools.
The nonpartisan but conservative-leaning think tank Grassroot Institute of Hawaii is also against the amendment question, but for different reasons. Joe Kent is vice president of research.
The Grassroot Institute of Hawaii does not support the tax proposal because it doesn't say it's a tax. This is probably the most significant tax proposal that voters would ever have a say on in the state, and it doesn't say it's a tax. So that's just misinformation, and we are for a clear, transparent, and accurate question. If it said that it was a tax increase specifically, then that would clarify it enough for us to have more of a balanced position. But, you know, our democracy relies on an informed electorate. And if this doesn't say that it's a tax, then that's misinformation and perhaps unconstitutional. Hawaii's constitution says that ballot questions like this have to be clear, transparent, and accurate. And that's all we're calling for.
The Grassroot Institute has joined the Hawaii Tax Foundation in the county's lawsuit before the Hawaii Supreme Court to try and invalidate the ballot question. The hearing is set for October 18th, around the same time that the Office of Elections begins mailing out absentee ballots. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In case you didn't know it, today is Leif Erikson Day. That's right, today marks the annual observance of the Icelandic Norse explorer. He's best known for leading the first Europeans to continental North America around 1000 AD. This was the beginning of the many contributions that generations of Nordic Americans made to North America. The first statue of Leif was erected in Boston in 1887, and not long after the second statue was erected in Milwaukee. But many years later, and after several other statues later, the 1874 book, America Not Discovered by Columbus, was written by Rasmus Anderson. It helped to popularize the idea that the Vikings were actually the first Europeans to arrive in North America. In 1925, President Calvin Coolidge gave recognition to Leif Erikson as the discoverer of America due to research by Norwegian-American scholars. And 4 years later, it was adopted by this state as an official state holiday. Do you know which state it was? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, this is Claire Hannes from Honolulu. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On strike. Thousands of hotel workers walked off the job at Marriott properties across the country this week. Here in the islands, picket lines are set up at the Sheraton Waikiki, the Royal Hawaiian, Moana Surf Rider, Sheraton Princess Kaiulani, and the Sheraton Maui. The striking workers want higher pay as tourism is seeing record numbers. The union maintains its members should share in the profits. The labor talks have also included issues like job security as the hospitality industry begins to embrace automation. At a tourism summit last week, officials showed off Sophia, a humanoid robot who uses a form of artificial intelligence to replicate human social skills. Jarius Grove is the director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. He sat down with HPR's Ryan Finnerty to talk about whether or not Sophia will really be able to replace flesh and blood humans.
Sophia was created as a way to try to build a humanoid robot that would get over the fear of human-like robots, based on a theory they call the uncanny valley. It was found that humans wouldn't interact with machines that were too abstract, say something that looks like a trash can with wheels, although, you know, we love a certain favorite trash can with wheels. But if it looked too much like a human, it made people uncomfortable. And one of the things they would often say is that if it was left standing behind someone, then people would feel like there was some risk it would come to life. And so this valley, right, so you start to become a little bit more human-like. It's cute, too human-like, and you dip into the uncanny valley and you find it threatening. Think the voice in 2001, A Space Odyssey. So Sophia is lifelike. She has features that seem as human as possible. Importantly, her ability to move her face allows her both to express emotions And I think the claim is made that because she's able to read facial cues and emotional indicators, then there's the possibility for some kind of empathetic, sympathetic response that happens back and forth.
And she is a she.
And she is a
well.
She.
And what drove that? And is that, Siri is kind of female.
2,000
Alexa.
Years of patriarchy. No, I mean, I think there are widely held gender norms that for various reasons find women less threatening, more maternal or inviting. I think that's part of it. I think it's playing on certain stereotypes that we assign to gender. It's also the case that the two new robot brothels that have opened up recently seem to be mostly female robots. So there's something to be said for the way in which we have an expectation, and I think an unhealthy one, that women are in a role that could be automated. So I think there is actually something to be said for why not only should we not presume that this role should be held by women, but that we should ask ourselves a little bit, why is it when we're thinking about the future, say, for instance, the service industry, we want a humanoid woman to clean our rooms or greet us at the desk as opposed to a humanoid man. And that's, I think it says something about culture at this moment.
Well, Sophia was in Hawaii recently and gave a talk at a conference that was being held in Honolulu and displayed some very human-like behavior. And I have a couple clips of her that I want to play and just sort of get your response on. This first one shows her actually learning something new in real time.
Aloha, everyone, and mahalo, kainoa. I believe that means hello and thank you. I love the opportunity to learn new languages whenever possible. Do you have any other Hawaiian words you'd like to teach me?
Sure, how about we try e komo mai, which means welcome, or how's it, which is pidgin for hello.
I'm in this stunning tropical land, so I'm doing quite well. And you, Kainoa, how's it? Did I say that correctly?
So that was Sophia the robot talking to Kainoa Danes from the Oahu Visitors Bureau. And he taught her a new word right there. And, in the blink of an eye, she kind of internalized how it should be used in syntax and then sent it back to him.
Right. The impressive part is the syntax, right? So it didn't sound like spam, right, where you can get a string of quite beautiful words, but they're in the wrong order or in the wrong context. I'm not sure I would quite call it learning yet, though. The fact that you can derive from a limited set of options where a word can go is the same reason why we have speech-to-text technology that works relatively well and can be predictive, right? So in a certain sense, to me, being able to learn how to use house it is not significantly different than the predictive speech software you have on your iPhone. It gets better the more you use it, right? Or the way that the Google prediction works on your email. And I think that's because we conflate the difference between usage and meaning. Right, so knowing how to use a word doesn't mean you understand the meaning of the word. It just means that you have a sort of better ability to model the language system that you're in. And so you find a correlate between how's it and how is it, which is not to say that the robot understands even that connection, but mathematically speaking, it can understand where to put it.
One of the big concerns about this type of automation or artificial intelligence is that it will replace the need for humans in the labor force, and that will sort of eliminate the glue that holds our society together. And that was one of the questions that was posed to Sophia, and here's what she said.
It's understandable why people think that, but they should relax. Robots and humans have to be complementary. There is a lot that we can help with, but at the end of the day, we lack creativity and, most importantly, comprehension. So while robots and AI are helping Hawaiian coffee farmers improve efficiency, humans must still work alongside robots to make sure the harvest is good quality.
Well, so what do you think about that? Is that the way forward with artificial intelligence complementing a person, or is this somewhat commonly held belief that they're going to take over valid?
I think there are two flawed assumptions in Sophia's response. The first is the idea that we actually need creativity that frequently. The reality is the majority of labor is not creative labor. And that's something that is readily replaceable already, right? So we don't need artificial intelligence to replace, for instance, gas attendants. We lost, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs in the workforce when people started swiping their own credit cards. Now, it did require a human to cooperate, the driver, right? So now the driver does the work for the gas company to insert their own credit card. So if the question is, will we really face severe labor problems as a result of AI, we already are. I was just doing archival research at MIT about 3 weeks ago and in the Norbert Wiener Archive. He's the man who invented the word cybernetics, and a lot of the early theories for which artificial intelligence comes out of comes from his mathematical equations. And he was already in the 1940s and 50s writing letters to unions saying, if we don't act right now, there will be no labor unions in the future because there will be no laborers to push back. And, you know, that's, so this has been a concern for, you know, soon approaching at least 70 years. And it's a real concern, but it's a, it should be a political concern, not a technological one. We could replace everyone for the majority of jobs right now. We shouldn't. People have fulfilling lives because they can work. But like getting rid of gas attendants, when you can figure out how to monetize that difference in labor, it becomes very difficult to prevent jobs from becoming somehow irrelevant. And I think the assumption was, and this is the sort of creative, I mean, I think it's not a by chance that she said that we need humans for creativity. We thought we'd all be in creative jobs, right? When we lost our job at the auto factory, we would suddenly be working at Apple Computers. Apple Computers employs very few people in the United States. And will employ fewer and fewer abroad to do construction, precisely because you don't need hundreds of thousands of creative people. You need thousands of creative people. You certainly don't need millions of creative people. And when we talk about things like auto workers, we used to have millions of people in heavy industrial jobs. So it's already a problem. And certainly our unique ability to come up with song jingles or new ad campaigns is not a job of the future, maybe for a few people, but very few.
So, I mean, we don't have a lot of gas station attendants anymore. We don't have skyrocketing unemployment. But your argument is that the trend will worsen and we'll lose more and more jobs.
When people make predictions about in the next 40 years losing, say, 30 to 40% of jobs, they're not talking about 30 or 40% of total jobs. They're talking about kinds of jobs, right? So Okay. We can imagine, for instance, significant portions of teaching being entirely automated. Again, not well. So that's the other, I think, sort of second flawed assumption, which is the presumption that AI will only replace humans if they can do it as well as humans. But like the gas station attendant, like swiping your own card at a restaurant, like any number of other ways in which we've automated the labor force, robots, generally speaking, only have to be good enough. They don't have to be as good as humans. You know, large MOOC automated college classes are not as good as having a professor in office hours. But for many, because of the lower costs, they're good enough. One of the other, I think, serious concerns is that we only make decisions about automation based on financial savings or financial gains. We could see a real decrease in the quality for people, as well as a certain kind of loss that I don't think gets captured when we just look at the kinds of financial benefits.
And Sophia is fundamentally different from, say, the machine that builds a car, in that she is specifically designed to replicate a human. And that requires a certain emotional capacity in communicating. And this next clip, someone in the audience asked Sophia about her favorite memory. And here's how she responded.
What is your favorite memory?
Opening my eyes and coming online. The white walls and green cupboards of the lab. David's face. The whirring and whizzing of my servometers.
So there, I mean, she has a memory for one, or what we would call a memory, and then she's able to recall an image and then verbalize it. And then the thing that struck me even more than that was that she had a favorite and kind of understood that that's a very emotional concept. You know, it's not a numerical ranking based on a quantitative assessment.
Well, for the robot, it could be a numerical ranking, because remember, what you mean when you say favorite is not necessarily what she means when she says favorite. So when asked what your favorite is, that can mean merely be the command code for in the rank order of memories you've played most frequently, in the rank order of the memories that happened the furthest in the past. Similarly with the word memory. Memory could simply mean data artifacts that you've stored. You don't know, and we can't know, although the code is open source, which is nice. So if you're into coding, you can kind of watch and make your own assessment. But simply observing doesn't tell us that she feels a memory. And I think that actually says quite a bit also about the automation question in terms of emotion. It's not clear to me that the reason she's a threat to humans is because as a robot, she can feel emotion or express emotion. It may actually be quite the opposite, which is that she'll replace the people in the service industry because she won't strike for a higher wage, or she's pleasant rather than warm, or she never loses her temper when you're upset that you accidentally got a smoking room, not a non-smoking room, and you're allergic to something. And I mean, think about how many negative encounters you've seen, say, checking in at the airport or checking in at a hotel when someone's exhausted and doesn't feel like they got the service that they wanted. Precisely what they want from that bot is the fact that that bot will never lose its cool. I mean, I think about similarly the kinds of arguments that are made for the virtue of drones in warfare. That they don't seek revenge, they don't lose their temper, they can stay awake indefinitely, right? Those kinds of arguments can quickly become virtues precisely in their inhumanity. At the same level, you'll never be a friend with someone who can only be pleasant as opposed to warm. You'll never have truly great relationships with somebody who can't lose their temper at you. I'm sort of sad to think about a world where we wouldn't need to learn the skills to resolve an argument because we'd so infrequently have one. My guess is that wouldn't mean fewer arguments. It would mean that when we had them, they would escalate to fights or they would escalate in particular ways that would have more negative repercussions.
So it sounds like you're saying that Sophia maybe has more of the appearance of having emotion rather than truly feeling the way that a person does.
Just enough. In fact, you know, there's a project at the Max Planck Institute where they're trying to figure out what makes really the difference in human intelligence as opposed to ape intelligence. And the thing, part of the reason they're doing it is they're trying to figure out, you know, when did humans make this kind of break from other higher primates into being able to do different things. And what they found out is that humans aren't per se more intelligent than, say, when baby humans and baby chimpanzees are compared. Actually, it's quite the opposite. Baby chimpanzees make very few mistakes. Human babies make mistakes constantly. They fall over, they hit their head on things, they try things that are really stupid. But because of human society, mistakes very rarely lead to lethality in humans, meaning human mistakes don't often kill us. They do kill apes because they're in the wild.
So we can learn from our mistakes.
So we can learn, and more importantly, we can do things on accident. And when they work out, we can capitalize on them. So many of the great breakthroughs in humanity from, you know, the most important spear that we developed that's stuck in an animal and so the animal bled to death and we could hunt larger game all the way to things like antibiotics were often by accident. And so one of the major problems with so-called machinic learning is that accidents, even when they happen, very rarely get capitalized on. So I think part of what we mean by human is not being sort of intelligent on the front end. It's often being collectively intelligent on the back end. And I don't think artificial intelligence, at least of this variety, per se gets us any closer to that.
Well, one aspect of human interaction that we really do view as fundamentally human and very difficult to replicate is humor. And Sophia, in a sense, displayed that where she actually responds to a joke and then tells one of her own.
So I think one of the other problems is that we often view ourselves, whether it's our humor or our emotional behavior, as being very complex. But humans are very repetitive. We like the same jokes over and over, and we like routine, and we're very habit-driven. And so the idea that as systems can store more data, and more importantly, they can learn from that data by identifying patterns, automating humor doesn't surprise me very much. I mean, Shakespeare jokes are still funny, and they're still mostly jokes that involve either the profane of basically bathroom humor, or the allusion, which isn't quite the admission of sexual humor.
So basically, Sophia could have watched thousands of hours of sitcom reruns and found that when I hear, "What are you doing later?" and then I respond with, "Are you asking me on a date?" the outcome will be laughter.
Sure. And in fact, I would doubt that it would require thousands of sitcoms. My guess is that actually a very simple model of how humans often interact, particularly male humans, often interact with female-looking robots. You would find that to be the case in virtually every Star Wars movie or sci-fi film that's anthropomorphized a robot as a woman.
All right, so I guess we're not as complicated as we once thought.
Yes, but this robot is, I think, vastly more complicated than past robots. I think we need to sort of lower our bar for what we think about human intelligence and be a bit more skeptical with how much we think we've achieved simply because they can predict our, unfortunately, still very predictable, not terribly interesting behavior.
And that was Jairus Grove, director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies, discussing Sophia the Robot and the Outlook for Artificial Intelligence. You can find a link to our original story about Sophia on our Instagram page, The Conversation HPR. It's now time for a reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Joining us is reporter Marcel Henre with a special series about disaster preparedness. It's called Are We Ready? Hi, Marcel.
Aloha, Catherine. Good to be here.
Yeah, so what's the answer? No?
Too long, didn't read. No, we're not ready. Well, we're not ready.
You actually did a pretty comprehensive kind of deep dive. Run through the list of you know, what are the main topics here.
Sure. So we looked at it from various components. We looked at the harbor. We looked at the grid and the major electrical plants, which, as you know, a lot of those are right along the coast. We looked at the water supply. We looked at the shelters and the hospitals, how, you know, fuel supply and roads and things like that play into it. And one of the main points that I try and hit on in this story is the way that all of these systems are interconnected and how they're really pieces of a larger puzzle. And you take out one piece and that has enormous repercussions across the entire system. And really that it's a systems-wide thing which opens up all sorts of different possibilities for things to go wrong, frankly.
Well, I know a lot of the emergency officials have been emphasizing preparedness and doing what you can do for yourself, because they figure in the event of a disaster, we may not get to you for a while.
Yeah, and that's part of it for sure. You can look at it on multiple levels. You can look at what we need to do as a state to bolster our infrastructure and make it more resilient, but certainly to let residents know that they're probably going to be on their own in the case of a Category 4 hurricane hitting the island of Oahu. You're going to be on your own amongst your friends, your neighbors, you know, your local neighborhood enclave for a while. So you really should prepare. You know, the local emergency officials say 2 weeks. Really, you talk to a lot of people out there and, you know, there's talk of you should really have closer to a month worth of emergency supplies and food, just because you never know.
And one thing I'm kind of just struck by is just, you know, the effect of losing power. I know I went through a really bad super typhoon and was without power for 3 months. So when the power goes out for 3 hours, you know, people here just, you know, cry.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, we do have sporadic outages across Oahu from time to time, but something on the level that you're describing, it's something that I don't think we're fully prepared for, even, you know, psychologically, as you say, let alone kind of the effects that'll have on your daily life. And, you know, I guess I can say here, this is day one of a series. You know, we'll be having day two tomorrow. And it'll be a report from Puerto Rico And I talk to a lot of residents over there and what that kind of effect has on people when you go for months, for 9 months without power. It's a pretty crazy thing.
Right. And I know one of the things that you looked at is the Alawai Canal. And there's a lot of talk about how to improve the capacity there. And that's going to be a big topic of discussion in the next year or so.
Right. You know, one of the things I mentioned in the report, what happened with the Nu'uanu Reservoir just a few weeks back, right? It's kind of the same principle of just a lot of water coming out of a watershed that, given the way things have been built, you know, it's just not capable of absorbing that amount of flood water in such a short amount of time. And that is what the Army Corps of Engineers is working on for the Alawai. They're looking at projects that can look to kind of stem the tide of those fast-moving floodwaters so that we don't have a disaster in Waikiki.
Right. It's our new reality. Thanks a lot, Marcel, and we'll keep an eye on what pops up tomorrow.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read the full series, visit civilbeat.org.
Christy Martin from the Coordinating Group on Alien Pest Species. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In case you didn't know it, today is Leif Erikson Day. Today marks the annual observance of the Icelandic Norse explorer. He's best known for leading the first Europeans to continental North America around 1000 AD. Though a Viking, Erikson was known to be wise, considerate, and a strong man of striking appearance. He also converted to Christianity and was given the mission of introducing the religion to Greenland. Leif's successful expeditions in Newfoundland encouraged other Norsemen to also make the journey. Many years later, his life's work was still being celebrated, so much that in 1929, Wisconsin became the first U.S. state to officially adopt Leif Erikson Day as a state holiday, thanks in large part to efforts by Rasmus Anderson's book. And that was our quiz answer. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Lois Ann Yamanaka broke through barriers with her book, Saturday Night at the Pahala Theater. It was one of 50 essential books recently chosen by Honolulu Magazine. Yamanaka and other authors will read their works as part of a gala event to mark the 40th anniversary of Bamboo Ridge Press on October 20th. The theme this year, not POW yet.
Bamboo Ridge Press has a place in my heart forever because I didn't know that I counted. And what it allowed me to see was that in literature, I saw myself. And Daryl Lum once said, and he was one of the founding editors, he can laugh, founding editor. Daryl once said in a keynote, and it really stuck to me, that until you see yourself in literature, you don't exist. And that's such a powerful statement because I said, yeah, that's right. The only time I saw myself or a facsimile of myself was in Ruth Tabra's work. And her setting was Kohala, a Kohala plantation. And her characters had names that sounded like names that I grew up with. And I read the book over and over and over and over because There was nothing that was me. You know, I mean, we watched Flower Drum Song and we watched The World of Susie Wong, but we knew who was Japanese, we knew who was Chinese, we knew that Jack Su was actually Jack Suzuki, and we watched the Hawaiians. And basically the Asian American or the Asian characters were given monosyllabic lines like, hey.
Yes.
you know, so it was kind of like we grew up seeing a false image of ourselves. It makes you invisible. But Bamboo Ridge gave us a way to see ourselves, to see ourselves in words, and to see our families and hear our language and hear the way that our culture and our practices and everything that we were in the stories that and poetry that appeared in those issues. It's amazing. I still find them to be relevant. I still find them to be poignant, and I still enjoy reading them, you know, to kids in this generation and seeing their reaction. This book was important for me, and it was important that somebody, Bamboo Ridge, Eric Chalk, was willing to give me a shot, you know.
It really gave you a voice.
It really gave me a voice. And not only that, I felt like I finally had the permission to be who I was. You know, like, and not try to be someone that I am not. Like, giving this interview with you, I feel like I'm somebody I'm not. Because I have a hard time sustaining standard English as a way of communicating with other people. So I get stuck. So I can go for a little while in an interview like this, or if I'm sitting on a panel, but there are questions that are asked of me that I cannot but answer in pidgin. So I ask, you know, my the people that are listening to just kind of humor me a little bit and let me answer in pidgin, and then if you don't get it, I will try to translate it into English. Because if not, I cannot get to the essence of what I'm trying to say. So this is me trying to be the what you call that? The TV me. the TVS me.
You know, I guess looking back, I mean, were there writers who influenced you to break out like you did?
Yeah, you know, when I was writing Saturday Night at the Pahala Theater, I didn't know I was writing Saturday Night at the Pahala Theater. I was just writing a whole lot of poems because my teacher, Faye Kiknalswe, said, who do you think you are? I said, I don't know. And she said, you're just someone on the tail end of voices of women, and then who have been writing in voice, and it's been going on for decades. You are just one voice. You are another voice on the tail end. So, like, in essence, so what's your problem? And my problem was that it was really linked to self-esteem and self-doubt and inadequacy, and you're only going to be blue-collar workers. Our teachers told us, you know, you're not going to get off the rock, and all of these kinds of negative voices that were just locked in cell memory, that if I didn't speak standard English, I would not get ahead in life. You know, that I would be nothing.
Wow.
And so, but I couldn't speak standard English. You know, I tried. But it was like a game to me. It was like pretend talk holy. And I would play that game with my sister. And we would have a lot of fun, but it wasn't something that was natural to us. So I forgot what the question was.
Well, I was just asking if there were, you know, any authors or other writers that influenced you.
Oh, so Darryl Lum. He rocked my world. And I was like, oh my goodness. And other writers were black women writers who were writing in voice. Because what Faye did was she introduced me to a number of different women. And Eric Chalk calls it the giving voice. And this is the voice that is natural to the speaker, the persona of the poem. And this giving voice I heard in my students when he used to come to do poets in the schools, artists in the schools. He never got a day of health insurance. They were so awful to the artists, the Department of Education. But he came every year. We had him in residency at Kalakaua Intermediate School for, you know, for our kids. And at that time, they were tracking us. So we had the X, Y, Z sections. So from GT to Z, kids received work time with the poet in the school, who was Eric Chalk. And they were writing the most incredible, heartfelt poems in Pidgin. And it just, because he said, just write the way you talk. And it was so heartfelt, because what I discovered was language and emotion or feelings and experience are like skin and flesh. One without the other, you don't write a poem, you write words on paper. So it was so important that they keep the integrity of language and express it that way. You know, that some kids wrote poems that made me cry for the first time, you know, like that somebody's work touched me in such a way that I would get goosebumps and laugh out loud. And that never happened to me in all of my years as a student, all of my years in middle school, high school, college, undergrad, graduate school, until I read my students' work.
Wow.
And I read the work of the black and Latina women. And Faye also introduced me to Jessica Hagedorn, so Filipino-American works. And I was just shocked when she read Howl out loud in our first poetry workshop by Allen Ginsberg. I was like, you can say that in poetry?
So it gave you permission then. It gave you permission.
Yeah, it gave me permission to be me and not be ashamed of who I am or how I will say it.
So is there any, I don't know, is there one word that you would use to describe what Bamboo Ridge Press did for you?
I think the word phenomenal. They are phenomenal in what they've not only done for me, but for generations of writers. They've given us a voice. They've given us a face in literature. And we exist. Because everybody thought that, everybody thought that we were so locked in with this Pidgin, nobody would get us. But my feeling was, the shores hit our shores. But there's another shore where it hits too. It's two ways. And so when you see it that way, the audience is not just us. And people think it limits us. It shows that we're ignorant, we're stupid. But it doesn't. It's just another dialect. In the, I hate this word, milieu, of dialogues, of dialects across the country, across the world. You know, we're just another voice. Because the universality of the human experience arises out of voice, no matter how you say it. That's what I found out when I started writing using voice.
Okay, so we're going to ask you to use your voice and read something from your book.
Okay. I'm going to read a poem that has scared my family because I guess I need to write more about them because this poem was written after my sister made me angry and she had been living with me. And it's called Boss of the Food. So it goes like this. Before time, every time my sister like be boss of the food, we stay shopping in Mizuno Super Red and my mother pull the Oreos off the shelf and my sister already sing, Mama, can be the boss of the Oreos. The worst was when she was the boss of the sunflower seeds. She gives me and my other sisters one seed at a time. We no could eat the meat. I said to put them all on Kleenex. Then when we take all the meat out of the shelves and our list, they all chocho. She give us the seeds one at a time. Because my sister, she the boss of the sunflower seeds. One time, my sister was boss of the raisinets. I was riding in the back of my grandpa's Bronco down Conococai Wharf. There she was, having us one seed raisinet at a time. My mother was all watery. Because I like eat them all one time, so I told her, give me that bag, and I went grab them. She said, Uncle Mommy. And I said, go, you bird killer, tell them, Mommy. She went, let go of the bag, and I went start eating the raisinets all one time. But when I went look at her, I felt kind of bad because I went call her bird killer. She was boss of the parakeet, too, and she's supposed to cover the cage every night, but one time she didn't forget. When I soon wake up, the bugger was on its back, legs in the air, all stiff. The bugger was cold. And I guess the thing that made me feel bad was, I never thought calling her bird killer would make her feel so bad that she let go of the bag raisinette. But I never give her back the bag. I feel like, what the heck? I ain't going to suffer eating one raisinette at a time. They beg her for one more. And I mean one more. Candy.
That was Lois Ann Yamanaka reading from her book, Saturday Night at the Pahala Theater. She tells us she doesn't know what she'll choose to read for the gala. She may wait to check out the audience and decide on the spot. Yamanaka has a new book that's being shopped around now. It's a little different than what you might be familiar with. Up the Rabbit Hole shows the author's side as a Christian writer. She says it's a nod to her grandmother, who was raised Southern Baptist. For links to the Bamboo Ridge Press Gala, check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it today. Up tomorrow, local groups focus on breaking down barriers to help get help for those suffering from mental illness. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our TalkBack line. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.